able to escape it. Billboards and headlines in every direction. That very day, Robert passed a newspaper box with a poster about the O.J. trial. "I'm so sick of O.J.," he said. "I don't know what to do. They have choked us with this." No one in the Monroe Club wants to talk about it. Instead, as if on cue, the never-ending loop of how people are faring back home and in Los Angeles, and what they have been through in both places, picks up where it left off from the last meeting, as if it were fresh and new and has never come up before. "If you look at it," Howard Beckwith begins, "we in the same instance as in the South. They throwing them in jail just like the South. The jail's filled with colored people. The South has made a desperate change. Things you couldn't do in the South, you can do now. You can walk down the street with a white woman. The mayor is black." "Who's that?" someone asks. "You know Dr. Pierce what run the drugstore?" Beckwith says. "One of his sons." "No, it's not," someone breaks in, one upping Beckwith and trying to prove who has the better connections to a place they still feel tied to, even if nobody else cares about the distinctions. "It's one of Dr. Pierce's cousin's sons. The cousin of Dr. Pierce, one of his sons." "That's Eliza Davis's son," a woman whispers to me by way of explanation. "She was my classmate. She wants me to know." Somehow the line of conversation reminds Collins about being black in the South, and the talk turns to a kind of testifying rather than an interaction, each member reciting an experience independent from the others and at times seemingly unrelated. Here it is, 50 years after most of them left, and they can't stop talking about the South. They are exiles with ties to two worlds, still obsessed with the old country, and have never let it go. Collins tells them about the time a white man slapped a ladle of water out of his hand as he was taking a drink. A woman describes being home from college and a policeman coming up and asking why she wasn't picking cotton or in the kitchen. Someone else mentions the movable sign on the trolley car and how you had to sit and look at that sign that said colored. Everyone nods in recognition. Marshall brings up the segregated lines and the swiveling ticket agent at the Paramount Theater again. "The woman in the ticket counter swiveled to the white side to sell tickets, and then swiveled to the colored," he says. "We walked up all those flights of stairs." "That's all over the South," Beckwith says. "You didn't know nothing different." Robert breaks in, momentarily distracted by the meal. "Era, what did you do with the oxtail? It's out of sight."
"Cake and ice cream? Cake and ice cream?" Mrs. Davis asks with a sugar voice, cake held up high.
Marshall then remembers an incident at Woolworth's, a seemingly small thing that let him know he was not meant to stay in the South. "A white girl waited on me and gave me a token for my change," Marshall begins. "I went to tell on the woman that she had taken my money and given me a token back that was worthless. All I got was the satisfaction of telling the man and of telling my mother when I got home." He recounted what his mother told him. "You're going to have to leave this place, you keep that up." Which is why Marshall ended up in California. Then Robert joins in. "I had taken my bath in the tin tub," he begins. "I was clean."
"Was that the Saturday night bath?"
Beckwith's wife, Isabel, asks. Everyone laughs in recognition. Like most black people in the South, none of them had had indoor plumbing back then, and Saturday was the one night in the week when they could manage the time-consuming ritual of boiling water from the well and filling a tin tub so everyone in a given family could take a bath. They knew just what Robert meant. They let him finish his story.
"A white man called me over," Robert goes on. "Hey, boy, I'll pay you if you can tell me where I can find a clean colored girl."
He pauses for effect.
"I told him, I'll get you one if you get me your mother."
"Foster, did you really say that?"
"So help me God."
"You lucky to be alive."
And perhaps to bloom. Most of them care nothing whatever about race. They want only their proper place in the sun and the right to be left alone, like any other citizen of the Republic. James Baldwin, Notes of a Native Son.
Chicago, 1997. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. Ida Mae sets honey on the window screen in her yellow-tiled kitchen to feed the bees. She gives away tiny seeds of 4 o'clocks and morning glories. They are a wonder to her, waking up as they do at the same time every day, more reliable than the best-intentioned people. In her kitchen, she cooks no differently than if she were in Mississippi, folding the eggs and sugar, butter and nutmeg, into softened sweet potatoes to make sweet potato pie, boiling her collards and mustard greens with ham hocks until they are rich and satiny, and then making the cornbread to go with them. She has no use for recipes. It's all in her memory from what Miss Theney taught her and her sisters-in-law back in Mississippi. She sifts cornmeal, white flour, a little baking powder, and a palmful of salt into a tin pan. She stirs in 6 eggs, sprinkles in a little sugar, and spreads a pool of vegetable oil in the baking pan before pouring in the batter. Not too long ago, Eleanor went down south with a friend and came back reporting that the people were using self-rising meal for their cornbread in Mississippi now. Ida Mae didn't know what to make of it. She would have to rethink what she was doing. It was a revolutionary break from how they did things when she was there. For generations, they had used plain old cornmeal back to slavery days, when that was all that they had. Everything in the recipes in their heads called for it. For years, they'd had self-rising meal in the North, but Ida Mae never tried it because that's not what they used down south when she was coming up. It wouldn't be authentic. But Ida Mae thought she might as well try it if that was the way they were doing things now. So she and Eleanor went out and bought some self-rising meal, and Ida Mae tried it. But the cornbread rose up like a pound cake. She wasn't sure if it was this newfangled meal or how she used